I'm Harry, an alcoholic. This is thrilling. I like this. Nice room. Nice room. Look at all them cold, fishy eyes looking at me like, what's this guy going to tell us we ain't heard before? Hey, hopefully my story. If you heard it, it's all right. Don't get ahead of me. That's all I'm asking. If I see you lip-syncing, I'll know you've heard me before. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a pedigree alcoholic. I have papers. And they fit me right in here. They help me get in and out of my drunker log. I think it's important you hear that part of it. If you're like me, I mean, I look pretty good now, and you say, this guy never had a drink in his life. Look at this guy. Who's he? These are from the Philadelphia General Hospital Alcoholic Ward. They have my name on them, and they're dated July 1st, 1955. Admission note. This is the first Philly General Hospital admission of this 23-year-old man in an acute alcoholic state. He was to the clinic last evening where the doctor recommended inpatient admission this morning. His present drinking episode began about 3 weeks ago, having consumed large quantities of wine, whiskey, and beer, but prior to that, he states that his drinking pattern was that of a weekender. He usually worked. I never had any trouble getting jobs. I had an awful lot of trouble keeping jobs. He feels that his drinking has gotten to be a problem since about a year ago and admits to blackouts. And yesterday, for the first time, he saw peanuts jumping around in a glass container. This seems to worry him. If you're new, you probably already figured this out. This ain't social drinking. I only admitted to one peanut. You should have seen all them bastards. Hostile red pistachio nuts. You think I'm going to tell them how many I saw? I know what they do to people that see stuff like that, so I admitted to one peanut. He has a heavy odor of alcohol about him. He had a drink this morning. Just one. 1951, he was undesirably discharged from the Air Force after having been drunk and stolen a car during a weekend drinking spree. His present drinking bouts have been exemplified by belligerence, numerous fights and arguments with drinking associates, which has frequently landed him in the clink. That's jail. In Philadelphia, they call it the clink. Huh? My wife says, you never tell them that part, what clink means. Oh, God. Okay, honey. This one's for you, hon. She ain't here tonight, but she'll listen. But here's my whole drinking story from the first time I got loaded to the last time I got loaded in this very next line. He is entirely unfamiliar with the dictates of alcoholism. He therefore is not aware that he is an alcoholic. There's my story right there. I am not aware that I am an alcoholic. Oh, I'm in the alcoholic ward, and the diagnosis down the bottom is alcoholic. But I don't even have a clue. They were so kind with their words. I want to read that part. He's entirely unfamiliar with the dictates of alcoholism. He therefore is not aware that he is an alcoholic. In other words, this guy don't have a clue, man. You know. And so I want to tell you a couple things about those notes that it doesn't say. That weekend drinking spree that got me undesirably discharged from the Air Force is the most expensive drunk I have ever been on in my life. I was at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, right outside Washington, D.C. I was in the Air Force. I was stationed with 11 other Air Force men. We were going to the engineer school. Had a good military record. I loved the military. I was ironing shirts in the barracks one day on a weekend, and three guys dressed in civvies said, hey, you want to come with us? I said, where are you going? They said, we're going to Annapolis, Maryland, on the other side of D.C., about 35 miles away, to a crab feast. All the hard-shell crabs you can eat, all the beer you can drink for $5. I said, oh, I'm tapped. I'd love to go with you guys, but man, I'm really broke. You know how we do, right? Oh, man, I'd really like to go. That sounds like fun, man. I'm ironing shirts for a quarter piece. I was always broke and didn't know why. So they got in the huddle. I said, come on, we'll treat you. We got an empty seat in the car. Come on with us. So with their car, their money, we go 35 miles to Annapolis, Maryland, and something happened to me while I was drinking and eating these crabs. Something that always happened to me, and I didn't know about it. I had a personality change, and I became nasty. Now, I have been told by a lot of people up until then, you know, you're a pretty nice guy when you're sober, but man, are you a pain in the ass when you're drinking. But that's as far as it ever went. And these guys, I got upset, I got in an argument with them, I go to the men's room, come out, and they're gone. They left, took the car, I go out in the parking lot, no car. I know they're just going to go to the next bar. They don't get rid of me, but there was a new car with the keys in it. So I'm not going far, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to borrow that car and go down to the next bar and tell them what I think of them for ditching me. So I get in this car and I start down the road, heading back towards Washington, D.C., and I know I'm too drunk to drive, and I know I'm going to wreck this new car. I know it. And I got my head out the window with one eye closed, looking at the line going down the road. And it's raining. Now, maybe that don't compound the problem when it's raining, see? The one good eye is now getting full of water, see? So I thought, I'm going to kill myself. So I'm ready to pull over, and there's a sailor hitchhiking. I used to say a sailor in uniform hitchhiker until I heard myself say that. I said, of course he was in uniform, dummy. How the hell else would you know he was a sailor? The audience is smart enough to figure that out, so I don't say that anymore in my talk about him being in uniform, see? So the sailor starts to jump in, and I said, hold it, wait a minute. Can you drive? He said, yeah. I said, get in this side and drive. Where are you going? He said, I'm going to Norfolk. Terrific. You're going right by the front gate of Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Terrific. Here's my barracks number. I'm going to get in the back and take a little nappy poo. You drop me off at this barracks, I'll give it a new car. And he said, fine, all right, hey, cool, cool, man, hey. He must have been one of us, that's all I could think of. He shakes me up, we're at the barracks, here we are, where? At your barracks, man. We got the right one? Yeah, okay, oh, cool, man. I don't know what else I told him, but that was it. I got up the stairs on all fours, got in my book, and any of you military people, ex-military people, you know, man, when they blow reveille in the morning, all present and accounted for, you best be accounted for, right? Or you're going to have to do some accounting. So here I am, I don't know, a couple hours in the bunk, I am still half lit. I'm out there standing, I am there to be counted, man. Keep my military career in check. And a car pulls up, CID, MPG, Armed Forces, police, all these cars pull up, and a sailor gets out. And it's like, huh. I knew they had 12 Air Force guys here and 30,000 Army guys. I didn't know they had sailors here, too. And then it's like, man, I know that guy from somewhere. Yeah, really, like, I wonder where I know him from. He looks familiar, you know. And then about then he points, you know, and I go, and I get handcuffed from behind. They caught him speeding. And they did a check on the car, found out it was stolen, and he said, hey, I got it from this guy, and he showed him the barracks number. They brought it right to me. Hey, wait a minute. I ain't caught. I ain't caught for nothing. I'm smarter than I look. They caught him in the car, not me. You just deny it. Wait, they got my fingerprints on the steering wheel. Hey, I'll tell you what. I was drinking with some friends, and they met some girls in the bar in the Seven River Tavern, and they ditched me because there was only three girls, and like I would be, you know, dead weight. So, like, they told me to hitchhike home. I'd be all right. I started hitchhiking. The sailor picked me up. He asked me if I'd help him drive, and I only drove about one block. And I said, man, I've had a little too much to drink. I don't think I should do this. Sounds good, don't it? They bought it. So they separated us. They put us in a cell block at Bowling Air Force Base in separate cells so we couldn't get a story together. And I was doing fine. I'm on a 72-hour hold for investigation. They got me, but that sailor's buying that one, baby. He gets a new car. He gets what goes with it, right? I'm going to walk. I'm going to walk again. It's just, hey, I got away with a whole lot more than I ever got caught for, and so did you. And I'm going to beat this one, too. This is a federal felony case. This is interstate auto theft, man. That sailor can buy this one. So I got 4 hours to go, and they have to let me go, and I know it. And our FBI guy walks in, and he throws this legal pad on the table, and he says, well, we broke up that hot car ring in a hurry. I said, yeah, big hot car ring, under my breath, you know, of course under my breath. He said, yeah, so that's the sixth car you gave that sailor, huh? I said, get out of six, Carl. What are you talking about? He said, don't try to lie. I got a signed confession from him right there. Read all about it. And I read that confession. That sailor said, who I never saw before, that was the six car I gave him. I said, that lying son of a... He said, what? I said, he's full of crap, man. He said, what? I said, I never gave him six cars. He said, how many did you give him? I said, just that one. Oh. I know, yeah, I know. I'll tell you what that cost me. That was one of the biggest blunders I've ever made. That cost me interstate auto theft, direct conviction, 2.5 to 5 years suspended sentence, 3 years federal probation, $250 fine, forfeiture of a lot of my civil rights, and an undesirable discharge from the Air Force and loss of all my military benefits. One weekend drunk, and the alcohol didn't cost me a dime, and it's the most expensive drunk I've ever been on in my life. Here I am back on the roof working with my father in South Philadelphia as part of my probation. And I'm bitter, and I'm back drinking with the same guys I moved to get away from. And the way I wound up going from a weekender to a three-weeker, now by 23 years old, I'm living in the city housing project in South Philadelphia. I'm on welfare. My father's still in the roofing business. I can't climb ladders anymore. I can't get up off the ground. My God, man, I could hardly get off the floor. And I'm on welfare, and I'm drinking in a merchant seaman bar right down the street, a couple blocks, right by the oil refinery. The guys used to do 21-day round trips to Venezuela, bringing crude oil back, and they'd pay them when they got back. These guys would come to the nearest bar called the Breeze Inn, and they'd cash their checks and usually buy a round for everybody in the bar. So I found out early on, if I went in just for enough to buy one beer, I could get loaded anytime I want, whenever there was a ship in port. And they usually come in about every other day. So I spent many a night in the Breeze Inn getting loaded for a cost of one beer. And I lived within staggering distance of the place, and it was never a problem. And I thought I was a pretty tough guy, and I could handle myself. And my biggest fear was that some 80-year-old lady beat me to death with an umbrella for going to the bathroom on her lawn. But other than that, I was still a pretty tough guy. I probably couldn't hit the back end of my rear end with both hands. But I met a guy that I was in fourth grade with in the bar, and when it came time to go home, he bought a bag of beer for him and me, and we head home, and then we go to my house. He's got money, and I take him to my house, and we drink the beer. Don't go far with two drunks. 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning, everything in Philadelphia is closed, all the state liquor stores, and I had roofing toolboxes on the floor in the living room. I didn't have any place to put them, and hand tools, hatchets, and hammers, and flashlight, and saws, and there's a state liquor store down on the corner. I'm living on the 7th floor of a 12-story housing project building. And I said, hey, there's plenty of booze down there, man. So we grabbed some hand tools, and me and him climbed on the roof and cut a hole in the liquor store roof on a Sunday morning and stole 4 cases of Canadian Club Quartz. I never tasted it before in my life, but somewhere I had it filed in my cranium that's what the rich people drink. And we got the best we could steal. And we get up in that 7th floor, and I'll tell you, from the time we started on that first court till the time the last one was done, I don't think either one of us was awake at the same time. I mean, I'd wake up, and he'd be passed out, and I'd start drinking. And the wife left. She took the kids and left, and that's all right. They don't have to say, what's wrong with Daddy, Mommy? So, now what happened was, when we start running out of booze, and we're milking all the empties, and I'm getting the jitters. My whites of my eyes are yellow. My face is all bloated. I got welts all over my body. I'm trembling like I never had before. And now I start seeing red pistachio nuts. And my feeling is, God, now what? Now what? But I knew what to do, because one block the other direction under the railroad trestle, there was always winos hanging out under there, a wine bottle gang. So I knew what to do. Man, they were the experts on drinking. I'll go find out how to get well. So me and the peanuts went heading for the railroad truck. And I come up to the winos, and I said, hey, man, I said, what do you guys do when you get like this? And they said, damn. Jim, everybody was Jim to the winos. Then they don't have to remember no names, Damn, Jim, what you been doing? I said, I had a little too much to drink. I said, what do you guys do when you get like this? Well, here, man, get a pull on this white port. You'll be all right. Drank some of that white port, and it never hit bottom. It came up, and man, I thought my chest was going to cave in. I don't know when I ate last, but there was a lot of air coming up. I had a case of dry heaves like I never did, and I couldn't stop. and green stuff started coming up. Felt like my chest was going to break. I'm leaning on that railroad pillar, and when it finally all stopped, I looked up, and them winos were standing there with their heads bobbing. Damn, boy. You better get to the hospital or you're going to die. And they didn't say this is meant to be suggestive only. Told me where to go, gave me a story. I go to the emergency room of the hospital, city hospital. Here's the story they gave me. The nurse says, oh my God, what happened to you? And I said, well, I was drinking with an Italian friend last night. His father had homemade wine downstairs in the basement. He told us not to drink it. It wasn't any good. It had turned to vinegar. We'd get sick, and he left, and we drank it. And I said, this is how I woke up this morning. They said, oh, man. And, of course, I'm still looking around for the peanuts, you know. What ails you, man? I said, I ain't going to tell them. You know, they put me in the psych ward, for God's sake. I know that. So they did exactly. Them winos had it off. I mean, they told me the whole drill for the hour, what they would do. And they did exactly. They gave me a shot of paraldehyde. It's ether and medicinal alcohol. They gave me a shot of a hypo in the cheek of my butt. It turned me a brilliant red like a cooked lobster. They strapped me to a gurney. And in 1 hour's time, I felt as good as I feel right now. And I thought, wow, no wonder them guys can stay under that bridge for weeks and months at a time. When they want to get well, they can get well in an hour. It was taking me a week to get well. And them guys can get well in an hour. And I, in my stupidity, if you will, my unawareness, it's like I thought I just learned another secret of drinking. I mean, the greatest thing I ever discovered, that some of the hair of the dog that bit you, if you could just, when you're sick, get some of the stuff in you that got you sick the night before, if you can get some of that in that can stay down, you can start gaining well. In fact, you get so well, you wind up right on another load, and I didn't see that, but I thought, this was a neat... I panhandled enough to buy a bottle of white port and went under that railroad bridge to my friends for giving me that new secret of getting well in a hurry. And just, I mean, man, we had some camaraderie like that. And I'll tell you, the next day I was in the same shape. I wound up going back to that same hospital, different nurse, same story. She's buying the story. She's getting the syringe ready. She's getting the paraldehyde ready. And I'm chomping at the bit, man. I am ready to take it. And the doctor walked in and treated me the day before, and he said, what the hell did you do, go out and get drunk after I straightened you out yesterday? And I said, yeah. What? Yeah. I came here because I couldn't drink in the shape I was in. Nothing would stay down. And you, whatever you did worked, and was able to stay down. And now it's like I needed you to do it again. He said, scram, I ain't wasting good medicine on you. Hey, it's a city hospital. I'm a taxpayer. You didn't waste it. I didn't file for 5 years, but I demanded my rights. My rights. He said, hey, I'm going to call security and get you arrested. You can't behave like that in here. You want help? You go up to the alcoholic or get a note saying I can treat you. Otherwise, I'm calling security. Hey, I was winding up in jail enough. I went up to the sixth floor alcoholic ward. Here's this doctor, white coat, down to his fingertips, full name, MD. How you doing? You got a little drinking problem, huh? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, you don't have a drinking problem? And I said, no. He said, what is your problem? I said, look at my eye. See that yellow? Look, check this out. I opened my shirt and showed him all my welts. Yeah? I said, look at this. I ain't never got like that before. And I never get this way when I'm drinking. It's only when I'm not. And what's sick about the whole damn thing is I was dead serious. I never got like that when I was drinking. I'd never be able to hold the drink. It was only when I wasn't drinking. And then peanuts, I never see them when I'm drinking, you know. So he said, oh, but you don't have a drinking problem. And I said, no. I said, okay, here. And he gave me the note for the quick fix. And I'm thinking, whoa, this is easy. I'm getting good at this, man. And he says, go get your quick fix. But I got news for you. You get no more quick fixes around here. And I want to tell you something else, kid. It never gets any better from here on out. It keeps getting worse. I wanted the quick fix. I didn't want to lecture. Well, I had a term to walk away from this guy. I had the note. I said, it does. He said, yeah, but you know what? If you ever decide you want any real help, I think I can help you because I think I know what's wrong with you. I said, what? You know what's wrong with me? He said, yeah. I said, what? He said, I think you have the same thing wrong with you that I have wrong with me. Now, check this out. Here's a 22-year-old kid on welfare, goofy, and here's this clean medical doctor standing there with MD on him, and he thinks him and I have something in common. And I said, you think I have the same thing wrong with me that you have wrong with you? What? He said, alcoholism. I said, alcoholism? You're an alcoholic? And he said, yeah, and it blew me away. I never met a sober alcoholic before. You call any of my drinking friends alkies, you're going to have to fight. And this guy's admitting he is an alcoholic and he looks good. And you're an alcoholic? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you think I am? And he said, I think so. I said, but how could I be an alcoholic? I'm too young. I'm only 23. He said, how old do you have to be? I hate when people do that to me. I don't know. And I guessed him about 45 years old, and I need an answer. So I said, oh, 45? He said, where'd you get that number from? Now I'm really in a bind. So I said, well, that seems to be the age that most of my drinking friends are. Most of the alcoholics that I know. He said, how many do you know? I said, oh, I know a bunch of them, man. And I'm getting the nuts. He said, don't you know they were once 23? They weren't born at 45 years old. Maybe they never had a chance to get help when they were 23. But I'm offering you a chance. If you ever decide you want some real help, you come back and see me and I'll get you some help, okay? Sure. All I got to do is turn and walk away. And I did something I never thought I would do. I began to cry. Now, I didn't know it then, but that was my surrender to help. And this is a time in my life I would rather die than cry. Cops used to pick me up for different things, suspicions of a lot of things, and I'd never tell them anything. And they had this technique with me. They used to take lengths of rubber heater hose, about a foot long, and just beat the hell out of me on the bottom of my feet and all over my body, nothing from the neck up where it would show when I went before the man in the morning, and it just beat the hell out of me. And usually because I couldn't keep my mouth shut, I'd say something about their mother or come back when you ain't in uniform and let me hear you, let me see how tough you are. And they'd come back the next morning when I'm hungover and say, how you doing, Harry? I say, do I know you guys? You knew us last night when we were in uniform. We're the cops that put you in here. You told us to come back when we got our uniforms off and you'll show us what you can do. Here we are. Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry. Because now I'm scared to death, man. And I got to go before, I don't even know what the hell I'm in jail for. And they want to fight. So it's like, my mouth always got me in trouble. And the way I like to say it, they beat the hell out of me and they couldn't make me cry. Then they leave and they say, one more peep out of you, we'll come back and do it again. They get down the hall and I'd say, peep, peep. And they come back and do it again. You think a guy would learn, huh? Defiance. So I start to cry. The doctor says, you're in trouble. I say, yeah, I'm in trouble. I need some help. I need some help. Boy, is that ain't the toughest thing for an alcoholic to say? I need some help. He said, fine, here's another note. I'll give you a note. I'll bring you in tomorrow. I said, tomorrow, man, bring me in now. I might not live till tomorrow. He said, unfortunately, you probably will. But here's what got me back. He said, hey, you're probably going to have to drink after you leave here. Drink only as much as you have to drink so you can get back here tomorrow, okay? Now, that was the first bit of understanding I ever got about my drinking from the time I had my first drunk. Drink only as much as you have to drink so you can get back here tomorrow, okay? I said, all right. So I went out and got drunk that night, and I don't remember any of this. My next recollection is I'm in the hospital for 6 days, and it says 6 days, up and about, no complaints. And the doctor, who's going to be my friend and help me, that got me in, he's chewing me out for not being at the meeting last night. What meeting? The AA meeting. I don't even know what that is. Well, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, these are people that have the same thing wrong with them that you and I have wrong with us, and they've learned how to live with it. And you have to learn how to live with it because there's no cure. I can't cure you. Well, that wasn't good news. He said, if I could cure you, I'd cure myself. I'd go to those meetings for me, he said. Well, that impressed me. And he said, "And I wanted you to be at that meeting last night." I said, "I didn't know. I didn't even know nothing about it, man." He said, "Well, damn it, they ain't going to be back till next week, and you won't be here." I won't be here? I thought I signed in for the summer, you know. I won't be here? I said, "Man, I'm getting 86 for missing some dumb meeting I didn't know I was supposed to be at." He walks away, and then he comes back. "Hey, wait a minute. There's a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous coming here today. Would you talk to him?" "Hey, what am I going to say, no? I'm going to get 86 then?" "Yeah, I'll talk to the guy, you bet. Hey, maybe I could stay for the summer if I talk to this guy, right? Show a little sincerity." "Oh, sure, I'll talk to him, Doc. You bet, buddy." He went, and next thing I know, there's a guy came in about as far back where that door is that's open all the way at the back of the room. And he's dressed like I'm dressed tonight. And we make eye contact, and he starts heading for me. Meantime, I had just been talking to my newly acquired roommates. I got 39 roomies were all locked in this ward. None of them are alcoholics. They all look like the guys under the bridge, but they asking me, "What are you in here for?" And this guy's making a beeline for me, and I said, "Uh-oh, there's a detective. They found out about the liquor store. Hey, he can't touch me. I'm locked up already. He can't lock me up. I know my rights." And my roomies, "You know, what are you in for, kid?" I said, "Alcoholism." They said, "What? Alcohol, you're kind of young, ain't you?" But I had the answer. "How old you got to be?" "Oh, we never thought of that. We never thought of that." I said, "Yeah, tell me about it." I said, "Oh, yeah, but you've been talking to that alcoholic doctor. He's alcoholic. He thinks everybody is, man. He sees alcoholics under the bed at night, that guy. Don't listen to him." I said, "But you guys ain't alcoholics?" And they said, "No." And it's like, okay, could have fooled me, you know. So here comes the detective, right? He comes up and he says, "You Harry?" That's all he said, "Are you Harry?" I thought, "What? He can't lock me up." "Yeah, I'm Harry. What do you want?" Harry said, "My name's Tom. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. The doctor said you talk to me." And shoo, the room emptied. All my roomies left. And it's like, oh, yeah. It's like, here's my ticket to stay, right? Sure. And he starts telling me about him. And he starts telling me all these horrendous stories that's embarrassing me. I go, what? If this guy's a detective, he's got... it must be his first case or something. I mean, really, usually they ask you everything about you, and they don't tell you anything about them. This guy's so good telling me about himself, he ain't even asking me nothing about me. All he asked me, "Are you Harry?" And then he starts unloading on me. "You know, I do this, and I do that, and that." What the hell is he telling? I can't get him admitted. He needs to go get that doctor and tell him all that shit. I can't get him in here. Now my roomies are looking to see if I'm still talking to this guy, you know. And now I'm getting really embarrassed, like. So the doctor sees what's going on. He said, "Looks like you guys need some privacy." So the doctor takes us over, puts us in his private office, takes some charts off the desk, puts a do not disturb sign on his office, and says, "Take all the time you need." And he closes the door. Now Tom really gets into his routine. And I don't know what's going on. I can't figure this guy out. Until he says, "You know, I once got so desperate for a drink, I threw a brick to a window just to steal a bottle of wine." I said, "Man, that ain't nothing." He said, "Let me tell you what I did in my life." And I start telling this guy about cutting a hole in the liquor store until I remembered how that FBI guy tricked me. I thought, "Oh, this guy thinks he's slick. No way." And I shut up right in the middle of a sentence. He says, "Go ahead." And I said, "Uh-uh." "No, you're doing fine." I said, "No, I ain't. You talk. I ain't saying no more." So he talks some more, and he runs out of things to say, and finally says, "When are you getting out?" "Well, that's the deal. He knows he can't lock me up while I'm in here. And he thinks I'm going to tell him when I'm getting out. I hope the end of summer, but I don't know." So I said, "I don't have a clue, man." He said, "Well, you're looking for a way to beat booze, ain't you?" I said, "Yes. Man, I got to find a way." He said, "I found a way." I said, "Get out." He said, "Yeah, I found a way, man." I said, "How?" He said, "Well, I'll give you my card. When you get out, you look me up, and I'll show you how to do it." I said, "Well, can't you just tell me?" And he said, no, it works better if I show you how to do it." He gave me a business. He wasn't a cop. He was just the opposite. He was a car salesman, right? "Sorry, Ed. Excuse me, I got to get a drink of water." They gave me a bottle, but I refused to drink out of the bottle. Drink out of bottles enough in my time. I don't want the newcomers to think there's something else going on up here besides me drinking a glass of water now and then. But he gives me his card and he invites me to 4021 Walnut Street, a 4021 club. Pretty easy not to find it when the club and the address are the same name, you know? The 4021 club and it's at 4021 Walnut Street. How convenient, you know? So he says, you come over here and look me up when you get out and I'll show you how to beat booze. No more trouble anymore for the rest of your life like you're having now. I said, all right. I hung on to that car for a couple more days. Finally, the doctor sat down with me. He said, listen, I need your bed for the new man. I can't do much more for you. He said, if I were you, I would go to that clubhouse to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm going to go, and I showed him the card I had. I said, that guy gave me an invite. He wants me to come from when I get out. He said, yeah, and go there before you go home, because there might be some surprises waiting for you at home. You know what I mean? And he winked. Oh, Christ, he knows about the liquor store, too. But so I'm going to this safe house before I go home. I'm figuring it out. So I get out of the hospital after 8 days and walk to this 4021 club, and a guy on a porch. I'm looking at the place, beautiful place, three-story red brick, big white pillars, big porch all the way across the front, colonial type, you know, just gorgeous. And I thought, man, I don't get invited to places like this. I get thrown out of places like this. I don't get invited. The guy said, who are you looking for? A guy on the porch. I said, Tom. He said, the car salesman? I said, yeah. He said, hey, Tom, there's a guy looking for you out here. He's in here. Come on in, kid. Very good. Now, in 1955 in Philadelphia, newcomers were called pigeons. And whoever 12-steps you, they're automatically your sponsor. So right away, I'm introduced to him. Have you met Tom's pigeon, Harry? Right away, they know I'm new. They know who to go rat to. That's my sponsor if I screw up in any way. And that's how I had it figured. Now, I didn't know what was going on, but we drank a lot of coffee, and we stood around a lot. We smoked a lot of cigarettes. Just about the time I can't drink any more coffee, I got to go home. They said, where are you going? I said, I got to go home, man. They said, why? I said, I got a wife and kids somewhere. And they said, how long were you on that last drunk? And I said, 3 weeks. And you've been in the hospital for 8 days? And I said, yeah. You weren't worried about them then, were you? You take care of yourself. They're going to be all right without you. I got news for you, man. You take care. You stick around. We're going to have a meeting here pretty soon. What kind of meeting? Well, so you could find out how we do this and not have any more trouble with booze. So that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1955. And today up in Carlsbad, we had a big, big party, man. Big party. Biggest party I've been to this year for my 45th AA birthday. Don't ask me if Alcoholics Anonymous works or not. I think you need to know, too, if you're new, that this is not something that you're going to try for a while and find out, this don't work for me either. Yeah, this works. But, man, you got to get into it. You can't stand outside on the sidewalk and wish you were part of it. You got to get in and declare yourself a member. I mean, you're in if you say you're in. We don't vote you in. You see that nice steering committee and Melody, was it? Or Melody, the chair? She looks official. She'll be out of here in December. She's gone. She'll be here a member, but she won't be a hotshot chairperson. And we got a thing called rotation in here, where when you get right to the point that you're on top, they rotate you off and you take a seat in the audience and somebody else gets it. And it's the thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous work so wonderful. I mean, they ain't no big shots. One shot, we're all shot. So they ain't no big shots. I mean, if this thing really works. So that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 3 months' time, through my mother, the wife and kids came back. But the wife said, I'll tell you, I'll bring the kids back. They need a father, but you got to promise me you'll never drink again. I said, I can't promise you that. I don't know that. The best I can promise you is that I won't drink today. And she said, that ain't much of a promise. I said, God, 90 days ago, I couldn't even promise you that. That's a beginning. Well, I'll bring the kids back. They need a father. But if you start drinking, we're out of here. I said, I wouldn't blame you. So they come back and 6 months over, I'll tell you, I have what we call white knuckle sobriety. Oh, I wasn't drinking, but I was still trying to be chummy with my old drinking friends. They say, why you come around? You're not drinking. You make me nervous, man. You make me conscious of my drinking. Why do you bother coming around? You ain't no fun anymore since you quit drinking, you know? And I don't know why you ever stopped anyway. You never drank any more than me. You said it, I didn't, you know. So it got to be like I had 1 foot in AA and trying to keep 1 foot with my lifelong friends. They were drinking associates, for God's sake. What we had in common was we drink alike. I didn't know it, but I was seeking out people who drank like me, just like me, so they couldn't say anything about my drinking. I didn't know that, but that's who I was drinking with towards the end, all the freeloaders and the guys that were stealing and everything else. So here I am now in AA, and 6 months over, I got white-knuckle sobriety. Enough to drive me to my knees. Page 48, alcohol was the great persuader. It beat us into a state of reasonableness. And we were willing to do what it took. And I got on my knees. I said, God, I can't do this without help. I can't do this. This one day at a time crap, my head's telling me, yeah, how long are you going to keep this up? You know you're going to drink eventually anyway. And my friends are reinforcing that. I need help. If there's divine help, I need help. And I cried that night. And it was 3 nights later, somebody talked about the mental obsession and the physical allergy to drinking. I thought, oh, I haven't thought about taking a drink in 3 days. Since I get on my knees and surrender to a power greater than myself. And I felt a sense of peace. I felt a sense of well-being that I never had before. And it's like, oh, it was peace, but I didn't know it. But the war inside was over. I didn't know it was peace because I didn't know what peace felt like. And it's like the message, mental message was, I'll do my part, but you have to do yours. And it's going to be okay. And then I had that sense of well-being from that day to this. It has never left me. But I'm still involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to 2 or 3 meetings a week. I sponsor a number of men. There's maybe a dozen in the room tonight. And most of them, if not all, were at my party today. And one of them drove me down here because he couldn't for the last 13 and a half years because of the ratty pickup truck he had. Now he's finally got 3.5 years continuous put together and he's got a new truck. So he insisted that I not ride in the van with all them, that he bring me down in his truck because he finally could. And he took me to dinner down the Italian restaurant down the street. And we just, if we had tripped coming in the door, we'd have been late for the start of the meeting. And we played it that close. But he's been waiting for 13 and a half years to do that. And that's Brad down here on the front. And another guy in the room, Paul over there, him and I went back to New York about 3 years ago, I guess, for the delegates banquet, but it was for the before they started their week meetings, and I got to go to general service. So I got sober 100 miles from there and never made it back there. 3 years sober, I left Philadelphia and ran out of money in Phoenix with a wife and 2 kids and took a job roofing in Phoenix in the summertime. That ain't bad enough. I wound up owning a roofing company in Phoenix. And till finally my marriage ended in 1970 when the last kid left home and I moved to San Diego in 71. And I never got 100 miles to go up to General Service Office. So now that it's 3,000 miles away, me and Paul went back for 5 days to Manhattan. And boy, I was stoked. I mean, I'll tell you, Times Square at night, they really cleaned that place up. And the place has energy, man. I mean, you could feel it like an AA meeting. It'd light the room. It's just alive. Boy, it's got a pulse. I loved it. We rode the subways and up in the Empire State. Went up to Bill Wilson's house. Bill and Lois is up the Stepping Stones in Bedford Hills. And what a treat that was. And there were no groups or anything, and Paul had called, and Miguel said she'd show us around, and I fell in love with her. She's wonderful. What a neat lady. And she's the perfect lady to do the tours. If you ever get up the Stepping Stone, her name's Eileen, but she's the perfect person for that because she talks about the romance that Bill and Lois had and talks about it and in that vein, the way she presents it. And it was so cool. And when we get in the bedroom, it's like, I feel like I'm in my grandparents' bedroom, you know? It's like, boy, I mean, the tears were streaming down my cheeks. And I noticed that one of the end tables had a marble surface on it. And I had been to Italy recently, and I'll tell you about that if I get a chance. And I read that the way you can tell real Italian marble is you put the palm of your hand on it, and you leave it on there about 30 seconds. And if the marble warms up to the heat of your hand, it's artificial. But if it stays ice cold, it's real marble. So I'm looking at that thing in Bill Wilson's bedroom, and I thought, I wonder if that's real. You know, I wonder if that's real or if they're faking it. You know, and I just had to find out. I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't read that article. So I go over, and there's a tour group coming in behind it. So I'm looking all around, and I put my hand on the table, you know, and I close my eyes. I'm trying to concentrate on, is this getting... So I stand there about 30 seconds. I'm counting, you know, 101, 110, to make sure I give it a, you know, in case he warms up, I don't want to, you know, so I don't want to accuse him of having phony marble if it was real. So, like I do that, and then I open my eyes, you know, and I got the tears running down my cheek, and it stayed cold. It was real. Well, then I start walking around the room looking at the pictures and stuff. And I turn around and look, and the whole tour group went over, put their head on their clothes. I mean, I knew why I was doing it. They saw me doing it. There must be something to that. It was, geez, like kissing the feet of the Madonna. I got to quit soon. Let me tell you that... After my last kid got old enough to move out, and my wife said she wanted a divorce, she moved back to Philadelphia, and I moved over to San Diego. And my attitude was, I was single first time since 19 years old. I was then, I don't know, 40 years old, 39 years old. And it's like, hey, I've been married 20 years now, I'm single, I'm sober, man, 15 years sober, 16 when I moved to San Diego. And hey, you could look like Mrs. America, but if you had dependent children, I wouldn't even go to coffee with you after the meeting. I mean, I raised my kids, you know, I ain't going to help you. And that worked fine for about 7 years. I was like a kid in a candy store, you know. And I met and married my present wife. I met her in 77. We dated for a year. I married her in 78. We'll come next month. We'll be 23 years married. She's got 10 kids. Yeah, I know. So... And she's not on the program. You know, she had a different program. Catholicism. And I said, is your ex-husband still living in the neighborhood? She said, no, he died. I thought, no wonder. Holy Christ. So we did all right. We're all right. And we moved into a retirement complex. Now you had to be 55 or older to live there. And so none of the kids can move back in. We have a new freedom and a new happiness. Let me tell you that in 1974, we had a U.S. president who resigned in disgrace. And the first thing the new president did, the first thing he did was pardon the other guy that had all these charges pending. I mean, he screwed up big time and then resigned in disgrace. And this guy said, pardon him for the good of the country. And it pissed me off, frankly. I mean, hey, for 23 years, I couldn't vote, I couldn't get a passport, I couldn't serve on jury duty, and I couldn't own a firearm of any kind. A convicted federal felon. Come on, a 19-year-old kid steals a car drunk, don't even steal a hubcap, don't even steal a valve cover. And I'm getting beat up for 23 years, this guy walks? Hey. So I put in for a presidential pardon, and I said this, hey, hey, if you could pardon him for the good of the country, you know, take a look at Hare here, right? He's been clean and sober for 19 years, haven't been arrested ever in my life from that day to this for anything I have ever done sober. If you've got an arrest record, ask yourself, have you ever been arrested for anything you did clean and sober? I didn't always know that. So I said, hey, I've been arrested a lot of times before I got sober. Here's my hospital records that I just got. And I was diagnosed and treated for alcoholism. I joined AA when I got out of there. I've been continuously sober from that day to this. And I think I'm entitled to a pardon. I think I've shown that recovery is possible. And they agreed with me after the FBI checked me out in San Diego and Phoenix and Philadelphia. And people were calling me up, hey, did you get the job? What job? Oh, there were some FBI guys here checking you out. They said, you're applying for a federal job. You know, I said, oh, yeah? My mother said, did you get the job, hon? I said, what? Did the FBI guys at your house too? She said, yeah. They want to know why, if you were single, you weren't married anymore, why were you living alone in San Diego? And she said, that's what I want to know. I still got his bedroom upstairs all ready for him since he left. Mothers are like that. They say, can we see? And she took him up and showed him my bedroom, waiting for her son to come back home. You know, 46-year-old son, then, waiting for him to come back home. So I got a full presidential pardon from Gerald Ford. And then, you're into my time here. I gotta finish. I gotta get off the podium. I said, I sent the copy of the pardon to the Air Force Discharge Review Board. And I said I had a good military record until I got, you know, this convicted of this interstate auto theft. And your commander-in-chief just pardoned me for that crime. Any chance you'd consider changing my discharge something more acceptable than undesirable? I don't want a hearing. I don't want to come. I don't want to go to the Pentagon. I don't want to go back anywhere to do anything. And I don't want any lawyers. Just look at the record. Here's my records. See what you can do. They then changed my discharge from undesirable to a general discharge under honorable conditions and restored all my military benefits. And I thought all I was going to learn was how to not drink and stay out of trouble. Well, I did, but as a result of that, other things, you know, I'm clearing away the wreckage of my past. And I'll tell you, everything was going fine until about June. And I got a letter from the Air Force Finance Center. And here's what they said, and I'll quit after this. They said, this is verbatim, I love this. Air Force Finance Center, after I got my discharge chain. We are in receipt of your corrected military records, and we feel a grave injustice has been done here. Oh, good. Finally, the bastards are admitting it. And we feel you have monetary consideration coming to you. Hey, that means money. We're in the process of figuring out how much that is, clear back to February of 1951. If you will send us your Social Security number, when we get it figured out, we'll mail you a check. So a week later, I'm in Denver, Colorado, July of 75. The guy that 12-stepped me, he was still sober. He was 16 months when he came to see me, unasked by me. That doctor went in the office and called the local club, and he had got Tom out of a psych ward 16 months before and transferred him to the alcoholic ward when he saw a pattern. Every time he was admitted to the nut ward, he had been drinking. So he transferred him over. Here's Tom with 16 months sober. He answered the phone. He took the call. He said, yeah, I'll come talk to him. He came up unasked by me. The doctor that put us together returned to drink and committed suicide. Tom is still sober. Tom still has to say, but he was talking in Denver, and I went to International in Denver, 75, and I told him about the Air Force Finance Center. He said, well, what'd you do? Did you send him your Social Security number? I said, hey, Tom, I had to give them a chance to make their amends. You know? Sure. They sent me a check, and it's one of them checks you can't see through the envelope. I had it on my dresser for a week, and I keep doing this, you know, and doing some little math, you know, well, let's see, $1 a day for 6,000 days, and for $10.80. I still have it. I ain't cashing it. Listen, they figured they owed me $4 a day for the 3 days they had me on that 72-hour hold, and they took 10% income tax out of that $12, sent me $10.80, and it says on the thing, endorsement and subsequent cashing of this check relieves the federal government of all present and future claims regarding this charges. For $10.80, I'd like to think I'm driving some federal bookkeeper crazy every month trying to balance his books. Thank you very much.